Welcome back. It's Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. This is our second hour. A few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Amy Fried. She's a professor of political science at the University of Maine. She's a writer, blogger for the Bangor Daily News, and she's involved with lots of areas of politics and policy here in Maine. So without further ado, we will play that interview, and thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week. So here's the interview with Amy Fried.
To the feeling of hot and cold, roll like a roll, like a roll, like a rolling stone. To the feeling of hot and cold. You took my body, you took my body.
Welcome back. You're listening to News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. Please join me in welcoming my guest, Professor Amy Fried. Thank you for being here today, Amy.
Yeah, it's great to be here with you, Steve.
I think this is the first time we've met, although we have been connected by Twitter and social media over the last couple of years. It's great to see you in person.
Yeah, it's nice to see your setup, too.
Right. I'm a little bit intimidated on the Twitter thing, and you're obviously a professional, and we'll get to that, but you're a professor of political science at the University of Maine, but you're so active in social media, and I feel sometimes like I'm a neophyte. I feel like a 15-year-old driving on the Maine Turnpike for the first time while people are speeding back and forth, and I'd love to talk to you about social media in a second, but you are, I think, obviously respected in terms of your work at University of Maine and as a political scientist, but also as a active social media participant. So I'm going to have to ask you some words of advice so I don't feel so overwhelmed on the digital highway. But why don't we start with a little bit about your background in terms of, from my notes, shows that you grew up in New York, went to school in San Francisco. But talk a little bit about where you grew up, where you went to school, and kind of set the context for what brought you here to Maine, and then we'll talk about your work.
Well, yeah, I grew up originally in New York and first went to college in upstate New York, but I moved out to California, finished my degree in the Bay Area.
How did you pick California from New York? Just the furthest distance, or was it a program that you were interested in?
Really more personal reasons than that. I was following a young man across the country, so... Yeah. But it seemed like a good place to try living in, too. And I really enjoyed my time at San Francisco State. I lived across the bay in the Berkeley area, but wanted to have my undergrad education over at San Francisco State because it was more focused on undergraduate education, while Berkeley had a lot of large classes. The professors were more focused on graduate studies. And then I worked for a long time, both as a volunteer and as a paid worker, for a group called the Berkeley Community Health Project, where I did various kinds of things from, direct patient care, crisis counseling, and also grant writing.
Was this in the 80s or the 90s?
Period? back then. And then I went off to Minnesota to get a PhD in political science.
Well, sticking in San Francisco a little bit, you have, and I don't want to characterize you, I'll let you characterize yourself, but a progressive voice, it seems, in terms of your political positioning. How much of a role do you think San Francisco played? Because San Francisco and California itself is considered, whether it's labeled as liberal or progressive, there's in many ways a subculture of the rest of the country. And do you feel, coming from New York, that your experiences and what you saw, and both academically and in terms of culture, that San Francisco and California kind of at least informed part of your thinking or sensibility, or was it basically just kind of an academic experience for you out there?
Well, I'm sure it did. I mean, given the kind of work that I did with people directly and also in, organizing things with this group and people I came in touch with. But, I came there from New York, so that's a pretty progressive kind of area as well. And, I'd be fair to say my parents were definitely on the left. My father was very involved in the New York City Teachers Union, besides being a social studies teacher. So, you know, kind of had some of that sort of politics. I probably was a moderate in the context of Berkeley, San Francisco. There were definitely people far more to the left than I was.
Right.
In some ways, some of that seemed just uninformed by the rest of the country. Just, you know, its own little bubble that, so in some way, you know, going to Minnesota, which is also progressive, but also highly pragmatic, in some way was a better fit for me.
So talk a little bit about going to Minnesota. That's where you received your doctorate in political science.
Absolutely.
At what point did you know that political science was the direction you wanted to go in, and public policy, and talk about that a little bit?
Well, when I was in California, a lot of the people that I, since I, you know, was very involved with this organization that did healthcare, most of the people there, if they were going on to other school from that, were becoming doctors, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, those sorts of things, and sometimes doing academic training in sciences. And I was at first, when I lived there, interested in some kind of medical sort of field, possibly. Like I was interested in maybe doing nutritional counseling, and was a biology major for a year and a half, and then realized that it wasn't really that good fit for me. Like, you know, there's some things that work well for you and don't. I did okay with the classes, but I wasn't particularly excited by them. And, you know, took a break from that after doing that for about a year and a half. And then I went back, when I went back to school and did political science, it just clearly fit. And it was one of those things where a professor makes all the difference. My advisor said to me one day, you know, you're really good at this. Have you ever thought of going to grad school?
Were there political events happening at the time, or were there political leaders? You mentioned a professor, which are teachers and professors can be huge catalysts. But was anything happening at the time that you really related to and said, hey, that's important stuff?
Well, politically, there were a lot of things going on. There was the anti-apartheid movement. There were a lot of politics involving Central America at the time, Nicaragua, El Salvador, and, you know, just responses to after Reagan was elected, the kinds of cuts that we saw in social services. Our organization did a lot of work in linking people to different kinds of social services. We had a big variety of people, everyone from homeless folks to just, you know, relatively low-income people and students. So, you know, really saw the impact of that and of Proposition 13, the big tax restriction that was passed in California. So those were some of the kinds of things that were going on. And I actually did think of doing health policy as my main focus at one point. But then when I went to grad school, I started studying more things to do with citizen action and opinion. So political participation, public opinion. That's the direction I went, by and large.
Interesting. You're listening to News Talk WLOB. Tonight's Morning Talk with Steve-O. We have Professor Amy Fried here in the studio. She's professor of political science at the University of Maine. She also writes for the Bangor Daily News, a column called Pollways, which I read all the time. So talk a little bit about after Minnesota. What was the impetus for going to another state that begins with M as you moved your way from New York, California, and then you kind of made your way back east? How'd you end up back here in Maine?
Well, you know, basically the academic job market, there's, for one thing, only so many jobs that are open in any given year in your specialty in the kind of school that you'd like to go to. So given, you know, where I was, this certainly fit. I also wanted to be towards the east or close enough to drive down to where my parents lived in New York. And, you know, it was a great fit. I mean, I really love my department. We're a wonderful group of people. I like the kind of students we have. I'm someone who likes to teach undergraduates, but and also do research. So, you know, having that mix of things. And it's a beautiful area, nice place to live generally. So,
absolutely. Yeah, well, let's talk about that for a sec. By the way, I was an adjunct professor for 8 or 9 years, and it was one of probably the most fulfilling period of my professional life. And I'd like to get back to it sometime. But let's talk about University of Maine and your experience there as professor of political science, and talk about what that program is like for either students or possibly parents listening, if they have a student that's interested in political science. What is taught, how many kids are in the program, and what is the curriculum like at University of Maine that you're involved with?
Well, I think we're just a great department. I don't know how many people we have right now, to tell you the truth. I can't quite remember an exact number of faculty. And in my department, we're one of the bigger majors certainly in my College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. But I think we have a couple hundred majors, something like that. And I don't know, just really a great bunch of students, a real variety politically. You know, we have very active college Republicans, very active college Democrats, independents. A lot of people worked for Elliot Cutler's campaign, progressives. It's just a really big variety. And it's the kind of department that we love to have discussion and lots of different points of view. And we have a great faculty that loves to teach. We just absolutely love working with students one-on-one, and we love teaching. But we also are really active scholars. And I think it's, you know, there are a lot of different places where people can go to school. I have always found that if you can have people who are great scholars and great teachers, that is a wonderful combination, because as scholars, you're up to date with all the kind of the latest research and such, and you're really keeping your mind very active. If you're someone who has to write for other people and have things accepted to get published, you have to be up to date. You have to be, you know, really thinking and keeping your mind very active intellectually. So you're someone who's teaching in that kind of way, too. I mean, you're teaching sort of, you know, you're not teaching to other academics. You're teaching to undergraduates, and you have to be able to translate that sort of stuff. But if you're someplace where someone is just teaching and not doing research, that's not good. On the other hand, there are places that are really research institutions where the professors aren't that interested in undergraduates. They're interested in their graduate students, and that's not any good. That's why I was attracted to a place like UMaine, because it has those sorts of things. And I think it's a great place also for people to come and learn. I love my colleagues. They're a great bunch of people. We get along really well, and we all really respect each other. So, you know, what can you have better than that in a work situation? We're right now in better shape, University of Maine, than other parts of the University of Maine system. University of Southern Maine is obviously hurting quite significantly, but we've been in pretty good shape. We've had pretty stable enrollments overall, also brought in a lot of out-of-state students, which is really important given the decline in college-age students in the state of Maine, part of the aging demographic, which is really a problem for the state.
well, let's talk about that. My position on the aging demographic is that we're not really aging. There's no natural or unnatural phenomena occurring other than, or there's no outside effect. People are just aging in Maine, but we're losing people 18 to 34. So statistically, it creates the impression that either, you know, it's not just an impression, it's a fact. Maine is the oldest median state, but it creates an impression that there's almost something that we're accelerating the aging process with people in Maine, as opposed to really focusing. So anytime somebody mentions that statistic, I believe it should be connected to the statistic, we're losing 18 to 34-year-olds. And to me, that's the more critical statistic in terms of the economic vitality of Maine, the educational vitality, and we're losing people. But before we get to that, talk a little bit about from San Francisco to Minnesota to here. You've, you know, both professionally and vocationally as a professor and as a student, you've seen some significant sea change relative to political activism. I grew up in the 60s where outside of Boston where there was busing and where issues involving race were very, very profound in my hometown and obviously across the country. From a political science point, do you see activism and engagement changing? You know, when people think about the 60s and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Kent State, and Ohio, and that was a feeling where people were against the infrastructure, against the government. In the last 5 or 10 years, it feels like that tone is picking up a little bit. You know, what do you see from your experience, both as a student and now as a professor, from engagement and from activism?
Well, certainly we've gone through big changes that way. You know, we don't have the level of just really active, involved populations to the extent that it was in the 1960s when there was so much that people were responding to, and really, really active movements like the civil rights movement, women's movement, anti-war movement.
Vietnam and the draft, which obviously causes a deeper level of engagement for families and parents, right?
Yeah, just very, very personal. But, you know, even when, like, one of the things that political scientists write about in terms of changing civic involvement is that just even, you know, various kinds of civic groups and civic organizations, whether they're environmental groups, any kind of group, used to be much more groups that would really get people to do things and get people involved, and people would maybe be involved in some kind of local chapter. And they could get involved in then, you know, a statewide or a national chapter. And so people would be doing things and meeting other people and connecting with people. And now we have what they call checkbook organizations where, you know, instead of doing something, you write a check. Like I know at one point in my life, I was a member of Amnesty International, which I think, you know, great group, right, involved with human rights issues and all of that. But when I was first involved, there were, you know, some local groups, so they'd want people to come together and you could learn about stuff. You could write letters, be involved in various petitioning, various activities. And then at some point they stopped doing that, and I would just get these letters asking me, you know, to give some more money and, you know, this kind of checkbook membership sort of thing. And then, you know, if you'd give some, then you'd be asked for more, but never were asked to actually do anything or to connect with other people. And it's when people are connected to other people that then they often want to do more things because they have this kind of social interaction. They build some sense of community. And, you know, in a way, that's what now I think the right in some ways is better at than the left, especially through, let's say, evangelical churches, where and other kinds of groups on the right, that they've managed to build more, a lot of times more of a sense of community in an ongoing way, where politics and people's lives are you know, associated with each other in a way that I don't think happens as much with progressive groups. And progressives often are less involved in religious organizations. I mean, not to say that there aren't plenty of progressive religious organizations, but, you know, there is, you know, less what we call in the jargony social science term religiosity when it comes to people on the left. People go to services less. They, you know, they're involved. So I don't know. People are not as
connected. There's also a trend
there,
right? Isn't the trend in the last few years, particularly in Maine, for people to be less connected to religion as being kind of whether it's actively involved or religion playing a bigger role in politics? You know, the number of people who are self-described as either agnostic or atheist seem to be growing, and religion seems to be loose, at least in Maine, and I think it's a trend nationally. But why is that, do you think, without getting too deep into theology? Because religion and politics have always been connected since the birth of our country. And it feels like there's kind of a little bit of a decoupling that's happening, at least on some levels. Do you agree with that from a political science perspective? And what's the phenomenon that's creating that?
Well, I think it depends on which side, because definitely religion and politics is connected on the right in a way that's quite strong and has been for decades, really since probably about, you know, 1980, even a little bit before, you know, responses to Roe v. Wade started, you know, used to have the, you know, very active religious right groups, and, you know, important to electing Reagan in 1980 to begin with and have been around for a long time. And often it's kind of a underground, not in terms of like anyone's trying to hide it, but an underground kind of mobilization that happens that way politically. Another blogger at the Bangor Daily News, this fellow Aaron Prill, who's he was very involved in the Page's first campaign and now is less political because he's become a born-again Christian, so he focuses more on his soul rather than the secular world. But he wrote a piece after Bruce Poliquin won the Republican nomination saying that one of the reasons why he won it was that Poliquin spent a lot of time in evangelical churches. He went to all the big evangelical churches in the Bangor area, which probably means he went to a lot of them all over through the second district. So it's this kind of less obvious kind of mobilization that happens on the right a lot of times through these organizations that, you know, no reporters really know about because they're not going to those churches, probably, right. You know.
I've never even heard that that perspective in terms of Poliquin, in terms of it almost – I'm not going to suggest that it was a campaign tactic because it suggests that it was more strategic than in terms of emanating from a real sense of you know, Bruce wanting to connect with an audience that's religious, but it does seem kind of interesting that it's why is one party versus the other? When we talk about right and left and Democrats and Republicans, how did that evolve in the 80s? You mentioned Reagan as kind of being a benchmark. In the 60s and the 70s, whether it was, you know, Camelot and JFK and being the first Catholic president and Jimmy Carter having strong religious roots, was the issue of Roe versus Wade, the issue of abortion in our country, was that the dividing line because it's such, and it was and it still is, such a profoundly deep, personal, and for many, many people, a strong religious topic. Was that the fork in the road relative to right and left in terms of religious engagement?
That was hugely important. Abortion was hugely important in engaging the right. Also, the beginning of the gay rights movement, which, you know, wasn't that big back in that period, but that was part of it, too. And then it becomes almost like this symbolic thing where people feel like their lifestyles and their, you know, kind of more traditional lifestyles, and often women not working outside the home or staying home to raise the kids is, you know, maybe not seen as positively as before. Whether or not people, you know, on the left are meaning to send that message, that's how sometimes it gets received. And so people are feeling that their kind of way of life is under siege, and abortion and gay rights get tied into that. And, you know, the left used to be involved, you know, used to have a strong religious element or, you know, ties to progressive churches. Obviously, the civil rights movement deeply tied into the black church, and then other progressive religious groups. You know, I'm Jewish, and, you know, a lot of involvement of the Jewish community with the civil rights movement,
sure.
You know, and with other other progressive causes at various times, whether labor or other kinds of rights issues. But I think, you know, you do see greater secularization, as you mentioned, and turn away from religion. And I don't know, when I talk to students, the students that are not religious or even anti-religious, I think it's because they react to fundamentalist kind of religion. And they think that's what it means to be religious. And they react to the anti-gay attitudes, which is definitely a big generational difference, you know, there. And so they don't like that. They don't like the anti-gay attitudes. They think that's absurd. They don't like creationism. And they tend to think that religion is just this fundamentalist kind of thing, which it definitely does not have to be. You know, there's plenty of religion which is not that kind of religion at all. And that can be, you know, quite progressive.
We have Professor Amy Fried here in the studio. She's a professor of political science at University of Maine, also writes for the Bangor Daily News, a column called Pollways, and also, as I mentioned earlier, she is an active participant in social media. Twitter is at ASFRIED, and I follow Amy, and I try to keep up, and she goes at an incredible speed, but really interesting stuff online. Let's talk about it. I've got so much to cover with you that this may need to be a 10-hour show instead of just 45 minutes. And none of this is in any particular order, but I'd love to get your thoughts while I have you here in the studio. First, we'll start with something timely and topical, and that is Cuba. And so there's an intersection of social issues, economic issues, and political issues that go back to the early 60s and the Bay of Pigs. And the recent announcement in the last few weeks where President Obama, and I hadn't even heard any rumblings, and obviously that this had to have led up for the last year or two of diplomatic discussions, but he made the announcement that he is easing some of the restrictions for Cuba. The plan is to reopen the embassy in Cuba and also at least start discussions with the Cuban government. And within nanoseconds of that announcement, a couple people came out strongly against. I think Ted Cruz, I'm not sure, Marco Rubio, a couple Republican leaders said the world was coming to an end. But for the most part, it feels as though much of the thoughtful discussion was the last 50 years hasn't been effective of either changing policy and the isolationist kind of doctrine. And so for the most part, I think people have kind of supported it. And I'd love to get your thoughts, both in terms of politics, economics, and social change, how you reacted and what you think about that recent announcement.
Well, it's certainly a big change in American foreign policy, given all these many years of having difficult relations with Cuba. I think economically it's obviously a plus because it's opening up new markets and such. I don't think this, it couldn't have happened 25 years ago because there was still so much anti-Castro sentiment and, anti-regime sentiment, particularly in, Florida and the Cuban community. But right. That's another place where there's been generational change. I mean, the younger Cubans do not have the same attitude.
And it's a different, you talk about Castro, Fidel Castro, who's kind of stepped to the side. His brother Raul is, if not the puppet president, he's the spokesperson now. But I think Raul's 83 or 84, and Fidel is either in his late 80s or early 90s. So in some ways, they're running out of runway now in terms of how effective and how much leadership. So I think it's a positive thing. And I think that there was a report on 60 Minutes recently, and they talked to some people there. And President Obama made this point, and I think it's a catalyst. One of the new elements of a new relationship with Cuba is opening up some of the trade embargo relative to communication and internet, and relative to allowing whether it's computers or internet access. And the more people that see and have information, whether mm-hmm. it's in our country having to do with our democracy or whether it's people in Cuba, the more people can see and be exposed to new ideas, new thoughts, challenging old ideas, I think it's better, right?
Yeah, I think that it really could produce, a lot of change in Cuba to have them open up in a way that they haven't.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of, I mentioned to my kids about Cuba, and it's funny how in the last 50 years, Cuba has almost been, it's not an active subject in terms of whether it's high school or secondary education. It's almost a footnote in the political Bay of Pigs and the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis. But it's only like 100 miles off the coast of Florida. So there's also this geography that is kind of unique in that you have this population, you have this economic element, and you also have this proximity to the United States, which is kind of curious, which makes it different than some other political and social changes.
Sure. I mean, we're not talking about China. And, right. When I saw some of the responses to Cuba, Obama's activities with, his announcement when it came to Cuba, I thought, gee, I wonder what these people would have thought when Nixon came out and announced the opening to China.
Right.
I mean, that was in some ways a much bigger deal, but I don't think he got got as much negative response from Republicans, probably because he, you know, himself was a Republican. That's why people say only Nixon could have gone to China.
But isn't it funny where some of the responses, and this goes into the political realm far beyond this one case, whenever I see responses on whichever side of the issue is, I always try to filter out what part of the response is just a political reaction or a political calculation and what part is really rooted in ideology or belief systems. And some of the comments about Cuba just felt like there was a calculation to, I need to come out against this, one, because it was a Democratic president, and two, immigration policy is a huge topical issue, and it'll be a political issue in the next presidential election. So it feels like there's just always too much game theory that goes into political discourse. Has that changed, or in your research and work, is that just a constant in our democracy?
Well, some of it is a constant. I mean, you could go back and you can look at the mean, nasty, horrible things that, you know, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson said to each other in the election of 1800. I mean, there's been some, you know, really, really harsh rhetoric all through American politics. On the other hand, we really are in a very polarized time, and people do tend to react. And I think it's always a challenge for people to think in a way that they're not just, you know, responding and reacting in some kind of knee-jerk way. But right now, we are in an extremely polarized time with, you know, really separate media, and people really relate to their side in a way that they're just, you know, part of their team.
Right.
And just they just sort of come out and say stuff instead of listening to what people have to say or really looking at evidence. You know, it's that's one of those things. I mean, as a social scientist, that I try to go back and look is, you know, are there some studies on this? And what does this, you know, some policy issue, what does it really say? I mean, there are going to be value differences for people as to, you know, something like healthcare that I care about a lot. Some people are going to say, well, you know, sure, maybe we could improve everybody's health, or we could do certain things for people, but we still don't think it should be a something that everyone is entitled to. They don't believe in healthcare as a right, so we don't want to have these kinds of policies. But if they then don't even acknowledge that the data show that if you have health insurance for people, they will get better care, and they'll get prevention, they'll get better health,
but
then
even
that's something where people are blocking, you know, just the factual thing.
I mean,
facts and values are different things.
How about climate change? That's my big thing, because healthcare is a mixture of both data, science, but some personal belief. But to me, I had a guest on a year ago who was one of the leaders up at UMaine in terms of the climate department. And I think there's 72 academic members of cross-discipline in terms of ocean science, in terms of geology, in terms of space and everything else. And all 72 recognize that climate change is very real. And we talk about isotopes in the Arctic and acidity in the ocean. These things are hard science, right? But still, there's a high percentage of people, most politically leaning, you know, Republican, that seem like they're blocking that. And that goes to your point about it's a different time. And I talk to friends who are educated. So it's not just a level of education or understanding. It's people are blocking certain data and putting a filter, a political filter, into their critical thinking. That's the part that amazes me, because I don't even see the political element of climate change. I mean, you could argue big oil, and you could argue, you know, the big money part of big oil, but it's like arguing gravity. And the climate change argument just seems bizarre to me, because we're on a planet hurling through space. All of our lives and our children's and grandchildren's will depend on the health of the planet, and people are making political arguments that just seem ridiculous to me.
Yeah, and one thing I can tell you is that in the last 20 years, it's gotten more polarized on climate change. Since people started, any time people started taking, maybe not 20 years, but, you know, 10, 15 years, started taking surveys on this, the differences between Democrats and Republicans, their views about climate change has grown, and it's grown substantially. And The term people use for that is motivated reasoning. It's like you, yeah, it's like, so instead of just reasoning, you're motivated to find a way to make it consistent with your political, you know, view and your political party. And yeah, I know I will talk to people who are, you know, climate change deniers, and they'll say, you know, I'll say, why do you think all the scientists think that? Well, you know, they'll say, well, they don't know. There's this one person.
There's an outlier,
you know, blah, blah,
somewhere.
Blah. But then it'll come down to there's some kind of bizarre conspiracy and people are making money off of the research.
Or they find some survey that was flawed, and because one survey done at one point and some isotope calculation was inaccurate, that means the whole thing. Or I love the combination of climate versus weather. It's kind of like climate change. It's cold this month, and it's like, that's not climate change. That has nothing to do with the overall environmental impact.
Right, and being cold in your region doesn't mean anything about the planet as a whole.
You can have the ice caps are melting and the ocean levels are going up. It is bizarre. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. I have Professor Amy Fried here. She's University of Maine Professor of Political Science, as well as a columnist with the Bangor Daily News. You can find her information on their website or on Twitter at ASFRIED. A couple other topics I want to cover. Now that we've attempted to try to create some understanding and awareness on climate change, we've talked about some geopolitical issues. Let's bring it down to Maine. We both live in Maine. I would say that we're both fond of Maine. I love living in Maine. It's been a great place for my wife and I to raise our kids. But we have a unique political kind of ecosystem here. We have about 1.3 million people, about 917,412 registered voters, 488 municipalities, and it feels like when we engage in a statewide political process, which happens every 2 years for various seats and obviously every 4 years for a gubernatorial, everyone talks about there's two Maines. There's either a North Maine, a South Maine, an urban Maine, a rural Maine, a wealthy Maine, a struggling Maine. And I want to get your thoughts, first of all, on the platform of Maine in terms of from a political standpoint and from the political interest. Do you think that we have so much either geographic or economic disparity that there's no way that Mainers in general can move in one direction? Or do you think that something else relative to the multiple schizophrenic nature of Maine?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that there's, you know, differences and different experiences and different ideologies in Maine. Just, you know, but you would see that a lot of different places, you know, and this kind of discrepancy between more urban areas and rural areas you see in plenty of other states as well. But it does seem like there's more division. And I think really the level of partisanship has increased in the state. It's going to be a big test as to how the legislature is able to do this time as a divided legislature along with Governor LePage. And I think, you know, I think there are leaders who would be willing to get together and talk, who understand some of the, you know, real challenges that the state faces. I did a thing last fall, this last fall, actually not 2014, but 2013 at the Muskie School. They had a series, Politics, Len, and Now, really great series, which, by the way, I think they have still up on their website, both the you can listen to it and also read the transcripts. And I was on a panel with Cynthia Dill, but also Ken Fredette, who's the House Minority Leader, I believe, still. And I mean, it was, you know, surprisingly, perhaps to a lot of people, I think we agreed on a lot of different things in terms of economic development. And, you know, I talked about some of the things I thought could be developed in some rural areas. And he said that would be great if you could actually create some kind of plan that others would, you know, in the future be willing to follow, some kind of broad economic development plan. Then you can, you know, sort of, from that time forward, do you see that sort of thing happening? No. And I think it's because people are so focused then on the next election often. Yeah. And difficulties. And actually some of the staff are highly partisan and not necessarily willing to sit down and, you know, they kind of promote the differences. And I think some of those leaders, if they really wanted to, could set a different tone and could sit down and try to, you know, create some common things going forward. But, I mean, really one of the underlying issues for the state, you know, it's just the level of resources that we're going to have. And if you keep cutting taxes, you're going to have fewer resources. That's just, you know, that's just how it is. And and at the same time, the municipalities can't do as much because the governor is, taking more and more of those funds that, you know, in terms of revenue sharing, trying to take the excise tax, kind of bleeding some of the cities and towns. And so they can't control their own destiny if they wanted to take different kinds of policies.
I've experienced it over the last 4 years in the Yarmouth Town Council in terms of what you're referring to is the shift of revenue sharing. And in one hand, Governor LePage cut state taxes, and it was, you know, he celebrated that as saving money, but it forced virtually every municipality to have to pass that along to, and local towns and cities only have so many revenue options by statute and by law, and one of them is property tax and a few other taxes. But I want to ask you to give a review, a political science review, over my hypothesis, which I've spoken about over the last 2 years. You may or may not be familiar. I wrote something in the Bangor Daily News a couple of years ago about 108 towns in Maine that were in effect. I think the paper, I don't know if I wrote it or the paper, but basically insolvent in the sense that these towns, relative to their own capacity to generate tax revenue to go into the state, were not able to come close to the revenue that they needed from the state. In my view is, I think that's the American way. You know, we're a prosperous country, so there's other countries around the world that need our help, and we accept that responsibility. Within the United States, we have 50 states, and there are some that are net contributors to the federal budget, and there are some that receive based on geography, based on economies, and lots of variables in climate and all that. And here in Maine, with 488 municipalities, there are some that pay more into state funds and some that receive money. And I support that, but I think that my opinion is we've made some mistakes in policy over the last 20 years. So out of the 488 municipalities, where, in my mind, there's too much infrastructure, and in the old economy, which was based on textiles and timber, and there were smaller economic zones where people would go 5 or 10 miles, and that would be the local economy. The new economy is much more global, requiring greater skilled employees. And new economy expansion requires density and efficiency. So my position is that Maine is so spread out and there's so much infrastructure that for every mile you separate a resident from healthcare, from education, or economic viability through jobs, those three key functions, you're adding inefficiency. And when people talk about bringing jobs to Maine, you know, I recently wrote a column saying that, you know, our greatest economic development boom in the last 5 years is funding all these economic development committees because they have meetings and they have post-it notes and I've gone to some of them. And in my view, capital knows where capital wants to go. It's like water or electricity. It seeks its most natural path. And here in Maine, over 90% of capital from outside companies and jobs have come to three urban areas, the three urban clusters of Lewiston, Auburn, Bangor, and Portland. And that's not to say that we ignore the rest of the state, but it's to say that we have so much infrastructure, we don't have capital funding for future capital needs in the state. We have over $3 billion of infrastructure expenses that nobody's accounted for. And in Augusta, most of the, you know, I'm a Democrat And I believe in the democratic principles that are tied to women's rights, to immigration, to labor, to kind of the humanity part of it. But I'm also a fan of math and science. And it gets frustrating when I talk to some of my Democratic friends where they're, you know, they say, well, we've got to do this program. We have to help this group. We have to do this. And I believe we should do all of it, but we should do it recognizing math. And the more we put the state in debt and the more the country is in debt, we don't eliminate burdens or hardship. We transfer them in another shape, which has to do with debt and repayment and tax hurdles. And here in Maine, you know, we have towns, and I don't want to isolate and name any of them, but in effect, I believe they should be ghost towns. I believe that if there's no jobs and there's no economic vitality and there's no hope in the near future for jobs to come, then the interest of the whole state is being hurt. And it's a little bit like 140 years ago when there was ghost towns. If there was a Cheyenne or Wichita, or those towns became viable, but if there was a town where the gold mine dried up and the people said, okay, we've got to move closer. Nobody said, no, stay. The people in Wichita are going to pay for you to stay in perpetuity. And the problem we have in Maine, we have a number of those towns where we're doing that, and in the end, we're not helping those people. We're not helping the people in some of these areas where there's no economic vitality. In my opinion, we're locking them into despair. We're locking them into dependency on programs, and we're locking them into in a multiple generation way. And in a political realm, nobody wants to have that discussion because the Democrats are like, no, we have to help all these people. And my point is, I think we do have to help all these people, but we can't do it in 488 places with a small economic engine, and we can't just say, elect me, I'm going to bring jobs. Companies know where they want to invest. They don't need somebody putting up a sign saying open for business. What do you think about, I know that's I asked like 9 questions and made 14 points, but what do you think about that reality in our state of Maine relative to, you know, the kind of the economic platform versus the population being sprawled out everywhere?
You know, you make a lot of good points. It's very, very hard to maintain the kind of infrastructure over a very, very large state, you know, with the large rural areas and such. And it's true, there are a lot of towns that are very small. People don't, you know, they live there their whole lives. They don't want to move. They often actually don't necessarily want to see a lot of development. You have a lot of people sort of rejecting change, right, rejecting consolidation when Millinocket and East Millinocket, both of which are shrinking, can't agree to have one high school. You know, that seems a little silly.
People living anywhere they want. The issue is,
right,
the issue is ratio, right? Because,
yeah,
you know, in Falmouth, for every dollar they put into the state fund for education, they may get 10 or 20 cents back. In some of these other communities, you know, 98% of the school budget will be paid by the state budget because the towns can't. At some point when the ratio gets beyond 5-1, 10-1, 20-1, the ratio of money that the state has to put in, and then it's a cascading effect where taxes have to be raised. Well, and, you know, burdens to get outside companies to come in go up, and it becomes a cycle.
Right.
And I think we have to change the cycle.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, another political element of this is these are often areas that vote Republican because they're rural areas and maybe they're closer on
right.
the social issues and such. So Republicans don't necessarily want to do anything to, you know, I mean, I don't know if you, I don't think you can just shut the towns down in any way. But, you know, I think it's still, you know, because it's one of those ironies that usually the taker states are more Republican than the net contributor states.
Right.
And the same thing is true when it comes to areas within states. You have the more rural areas that tend to be net beneficiaries that are more Republicans than the areas that, you know, like the cities and that are contributing. I think that anything that happens, that has to be kind of more, I don't know how to put it, but just sort of smarter answers. I mean, public-private kinds of partnerships, thinking about business. I mean, I went back and I, after this last election, I went back and I looked at when Bill Clinton ran for president, the kinds of things that he was arguing about. He was arguing about the middle class. He had a kind of slogan to reform and invest. You're putting money into programs, but only after really thinking about, do they work? This goes back to my thing of looking at the evidence.
Right.
And there's more and more really very good evidence-based policy research. Brookings just came out with a great book, the think tank about evidence-based policy, and evidently the Obama administration has been really interested in this. So besides giving money to programs, they make them really assess and evaluate what's working. And
but they had, 46% of people don't believe in climate change,
right.
And 32% of people still believe that President Obama may have been born in Kenya.
Right. But I mean,
all the evidence in the world doesn't change a mindset that is
absolutely
so close. By the way, we have Professor Amy Fried here in the studio, WLOB, 1310 AM. But that's my frustration of, you can have all the evidence, but we're in a climate right now where people aren't even looking at it through reason, through critical
absolutely
thinking and analysis. And that is where I think our biggest risk is, that people aren't, and then it becomes personal interest or personal, then it becomes arbitrary, like, you know, the Red Sox are better than the Yankees, and it has nothing to do with anything. And then it becomes so calcified in anger and sometimes hate between one party and another that very little gets done.
Yeah, I think we're in a very difficult time. On the other hand, you know, I am somewhat of an optimist most of the time, not always, but most of the time. And sometimes you do see some things that there are some possibilities. I mean, I think, for example, the Maine Chamber of Commerce recognizes a lot about the demographic issues in the state, may be interested in doing things. One of the things that I've been involved in that may seem really off my main work in some ways is out of I'm part of this big grant that from the National Science Foundation helped write this big grant to, and it's really was for because of the program is for women faculty in social behavioral sciences and STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. But we wrote a supplementary grant as part of it, won this grant to start a kind of hiring consortium, which we've kicked off in the Bangor region and out to, let's say, Bar Harbor with different employers and the university, so that when somebody comes to the area, who's getting hired or who's looking at a job there, to share a lot of information about the area, to help a spouse or partner to learn about other job possibilities. So, you know, because if, you know, and this is definitely an issue for the university, but it's an issue for a lot of other employers.
Well, Amy, I only get to about 10% of my questions, so I'm going to have to invite you back. It's been so nice having you here. I really appreciate you coming in.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure.
We've had Professor Amy Fried here in the studio. She's professor of political science at University of Maine. Please check out her columns in the Bangor Daily News. They are online. And also, if you can keep up with Amy on Twitter, which she goes at kind of a breakneck speed, but really interesting topics, interesting conversation, and I consider her one of the thought leaders here in Maine relative to having civil discourse on how to make Maine better from a political and from an economic standpoint. You can go to her Twitter at @ASFRIED. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. Thank you.